Well, it's certainly a pleasure to come again to this campus to read my poems, because it was on this campus that I first read my poems in the Bay Area 30 years ago, awful long time ago. I guess everybody, even the graduate students, have not graduated. Were they here at that time? In reading my poetry, as I have been doing for a long time now, I try to show how poetry is related to life. I know that in a college community like this, you don't have the conception that many Americans do, that poetry is something way off up in the sky somewhere. I'm sure you know that it isn't. Certainly in my own case, my own poems are, I think, very much down to earth. They are poems that have grown right out of my own life, out of places I've been, things I've done, and people I've known, the way I think and feel about things. And so in reading them to you, I'm going to give you something of their background. I'm going to start at the very beginning with my own origin, which took place in a town called Joplin, Missouri. But I belong to a family that was always moving, and I was supposed to have been born in Guthrie, Oklahoma, but we moved about a week before, and so I was born in Missouri. And then we moved all around the Middle West. As a child, I lived in a great many different towns, and knew best Lawrence, Kansas, where my grandmother lived, and ever so often I lived with her for a little while. And so I sort of grew up in the very heart of our country, in the very middle of the United States. I never thought about being a writer as a child at all, never dreamed of trying to write poetry or anything else. I wanted to be a streetcar conductor. We went to so many different towns and never had enough nickels to write the ends of all the car lines. But when I was 13, we moved from Lawrence to a town called Lincoln, Illinois. And it was this change in residence that brought about a very big change in my life. We moved in the late fall. I was several weeks late entering the eighth grade graduating class in the grammar school in this new town. And on the day that I went into the school, the pupils were talking about holding a class selection. It seems that they'd heard that the high school graduating class had officers, so the eighth grade wanted to have them too. And the teacher was explaining to the class the qualifications that the officers should have. A president should know how to run a meeting, and secretary should at least know how to write, and so on. And when she got down to the office of class poet, she stressed rhythm. Over and over, she mentioned the word rhythm. Well, the election was the next day. On the way home from school, I walked along with the one other Negro pupil in the class, a girl, and she said to me, we don't need to worry about this old class selection. She said they never elect colored kids to anything in these schools here. Well, she was just about right. She told me it was a prejudiced little town, and it was at that time. It was the kind of town where if you were colored and wanted to go to the movies, you had to sit in the last row on the left, which had only about 10 seats, and if those 10 seats were full, no other colored people could go to the movies that night. Well, at any rate, I wasn't worried about being nominated or elected to anything in the class because I was brand new in the school. It didn't occur to me that they would elect me to anything. However, the next day when the elections were being held, nobody nominated the colored girl for anything. She'd been with them through all the eighth grades. All the officers, president, secretary, right on down to the sergeant at arms had been nominated and elected, except the class poet. That was way down at the bottom of the board. Well, when they got onto that office, there weren't any nominations. And the youngsters looked all around at each other, and nobody even looked like he or she could write a poem in the room. So they wondered who to make class poet, and finally the teacher said, well, you do want a class poet, don't you? And everybody said, yes. He said, well, you have to nominate somebody. Have to nominate somebody, she said. Whereupon a little white boy got up, turned around, looked at me, called my name, and the whole class said, aye, unanimously. And that's the way I became a poet, by unanimous acclamation in the eighth grade. Well, now, I didn't want to be class poet either. I was a little bit... a little bit put out that they had made me the class poet. So I began to wonder why, you know, and I thought about it rather seriously that night. And then I remembered how the teacher had stressed rhythm. And I recall that all my life I'd heard that practically all white people think that all Negroes can sing and dance and that all of us have a sense of rhythm. Well, now, of course, that's not 100% true by any means. Insofar as singing goes, I am one Negro that can't even carry a tune. I was excused from music all the way through high school. I threw everybody else off key. But the concept of Negroes and rhythm seemed to go together, I think, in the minds of those children. And so when they finally decided, well, they had to have a class poet, they thought about rhythm, they turned around and looked at me colored and made me the class poet. Well, I'm glad they did, because ever since then, I've been writing. I had all winter long to write my first poem, so by the time spring came around, graduation time, this poem was just about the longest poem I've ever written, even up to now. 16 pages long it was. When I read it at graduation, it's a wonder anybody really liked it, but they seemed to. The parents, the teachers, the students, everybody applauded so loudly, and that was the first applause I'd ever had in my life. They applauded so loudly that I was greatly pleased by this attention, and so ever since then I've been writing and reading poetry. Well, now, the next year in high school, where we had a very good high school magazine, and during the summer we moved again, we moved to Cleveland, Ohio, I began to write for this magazine, and my first poems were published in my high school magazine. Right on through college, I wrote for the college publications. I was class poet in high school. Again, in college, I was a class lyricist. And so my literary career is really very much tied up with my academic background. And one teacher in particular in high school, I owe a very great debt of gratitude. In fact, I think all of her pupils do. And out of her classes came a number of writers. She happened to be a teacher who liked contemporary poetry. Now, of course, that wouldn't be too unusual today. But when I was in high school, it seemed that the teachers liked only poets who lived at least 100 years or 200 before the students, you see. And they never seemed to read to us from anybody living who wrote about anything that we knew. But this teacher did. She would read to us from the poems of Edgar Lee Masters, of Edna St. Vincent Millay, of Carl Sandburg, all of whom were poets living and writing in our own time, American poets. And I particularly like Carl Sandburg. So when I began to try to write poetry seriously, I wrote, on the one hand, like Carl Sandburg in free verse, and on the other hand, tried to write like Paul Laurence Dunbar, the great Negro poet who had died when I, just about the time I was born, I guess, but his poems were in every Negro home in the Middle West when I was a child. Now, you know that Dunbar wrote in a kind of singing, lyrical form and used very often Negro dialect, had a lot of humor in his poetry, and Sandburg wrote entirely in unrhymed free verse, two quite opposite influences. Well, I'll read you two of my high school poems, the first one to be published in my high school magazine, and it's in the manner of Paul Laurence Dunbar. It goes like this. I had my clothes cleaned, just like new. I put them on, but it still feels blue. I bought a new hat, sure is fine, but I wish I had back that old gal of mine. I got new shoes, they don't hurt my feet, but I ain't got nobody for to call me sweet. Pretty sad, that one, isn't it? Well, a year or two later, I wrote this poem in which you can plainly see the Sandburg influence, I think, and also you can detect the influence of the Negro spirituals in the little refrain in the poem. I wasn't aware of the influence of Negro folk songs on my work at that time. In fact, I know I wasn't, but nevertheless, it seemed to have been there. This is a poem called When Sue Wears Red. It's about a very beautiful brown-skinned girl who had come up from the South in one of those great migrations of Negro workers after the First World War, and she'd come into our school, and she used to wear very often a red dress and walk down the hall in this pretty red dress. And so I tried to describe her. I was too shy to put her real name on the poem. Her name wasn't Sue, but this is the way the poem goes. When Susanna Jones wears red, her face is like an ancient cameo turned brown by the ages. Come with a blast of trumpets, Jesus. When Susanna Jones wears red, a queen from some time-dead Egyptian night walks once again. Blow trumpets, Jesus. And the beauty of Susanna Jones in red burns in my heart a love fire, sharp like pain. Sweet silver trumpets, Jesus. That's the way I felt every time I saw that girl in those days. But she didn't marry me. She married somebody else as soon as she graduated from high school. And the last time I was back home in Cleveland, I heard that she's been married 4 times since then. Well, my father, who lived in Mexico City, sent for me to come down there when I came out of high school. He had gone away from this country because he didn't like the color line here. He'd wanted to be a lawyer as a young man, and it seemed there was no place in the part of the country where he lived that Negroes could study law. They wouldn't even let you study law. So he took it by correspondence. He passed the correspondence courses, got ready to take the examinations for the bar, and it seemed then they wouldn't even let a Negro take the examinations for the bar in Oklahoma or Missouri. I've forgotten which state at the time. And so he was so put out by this that he decided to go away to another country. He became a lawyer in Mexico City and practiced there for more than 30 years. And when I got on to Mexico City, my father, being a lawyer at that time for mining interest, wanted me to be a mining engineer. He got my career all cut out for me. He said, I'm going to send you to Switzerland, to college. In Switzerland, you can take mining engineering, and you can also learn 3 languages at once. Switzerland, you see, is a trilingual country, Italian, German, and French, I believe. And then he said, you won't have to live and fight against prejudice in the United States. You can live anywhere in the world you want to. Well, I didn't want to go to Switzerland to college. I didn't want to be a mining engineer. And I didn't want to learn 3 languages at once either. I wanted to go to Harlem. I'd never seen Harlem. And I'd begun to read a great deal about that center of Negro life and culture. I knew that if I told my father I wanted to go to Harlem, I'd never get there, at least not with his help, because he didn't see any sense of Negroes living in this country at all, and he didn't want me to come back here. Well, I finally was able to persuade him that Columbia University had a very good college leading to engineering school, and I would take subjects leading to engineering school if he let me go to Columbia. Well, he finally consented. So I went to Columbia, and I did take trigonometry and physics and chemistry and some other subjects that I subjects I didn't do very well in. So at the end of my freshman year in college, by that time I'd had 2 or 3 of my poems published in The Crisis, the Negro magazine of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Dr. Du Bois was my first editor, the first person to publish my poems outside of school. And 1 or 2 other magazines had taken little poems of mine. And so I wanted to be a writer. I really seriously thought of that as a career by this time. And I wrote my father and told him I'd made up my mind to be a writer. And if he didn't approve of my plans, why, he need not send me any more money. Well, it soon became obvious that he didn't approve because he didn't send me another penny. And I found myself in June, when classes were out, with only $13. Well, I had to find a job right away, of course, and find a place to stay. So I went down to Harlem, this Harlem that I wanted to live in so much. This was my chance. $7.50 a week for room rent, half of my money gone for just 1 week's rent, which was high at that time. And I learned that in the ghetto sections of our big American cities, even Negro landlords take advantage of the fact that you can't rent all over town like other people can if you're colored, and they charge you just a little bit more. I also learned when I set out to make my own living why my father had gone away to another country. At least I understood it better, because I bought the morning papers in New York, got up bright and early, 6 o'clock one morning, a lot of ads in the papers, help wanted, no depression at that time, and I thought with a high school education, a year of college, that I could at least be an office boy or filing clerk or something like that, and so I picked out those kinds of ads to answer, and in every single office I was turned down, usually politely, evasively, the job's been filled or must be some mistake, we don't need anyone. But in a number of offices, I was told quite frankly, we're sorry, but we don't hire Negroes here. No colored people work in this office. We don't have a porter's job here. And I began to find out that there are just thousands of ordinary jobs that white people at least may apply for without anyone being astonished. But if you're colored, they're surprised, you know. Well, that condition, I must say, has changed greatly in our larger northern cities, and I think in the western cities too, like San Francisco. But 25 years or more ago, Negroes were mostly expected to be porters or shoeshine boys or errand boys or elevator boys or waiters or something like that. Now today, of course, in New York, you see colored girl clerks in Lord & Taylor's or Macy's. In my publisher's offices, I see Negro stenographers, Negro office boys. So I'm very happy to say that in the bigger cities, the conditions have changed, but they haven't, by and large, all across the heart of our country. You walk down the main street in, say, a town like Omaha, Nebraska, and you just never see a Negro clerk in a shop or a Negro teller in the banks or anything. So I think these poems that I wrote at that time about the problems of earning a living if you're colored, I think they're still valid, by and large, for most of our country. I'll read you just one of them. Oh, this is a poem called Elevator Boy. It goes like this. I got a job now running an elevator in the Denison Hotel in Jersey. Job ain't no good, though. No money around. Jobs are just chances like everything else. Maybe a little luck now, maybe not. Maybe a good job sometimes. Step out of the barrel, boy. Two new suits and a lot of money. Maybe no luck for a long time. Only the elevators going up and down, up and down. Or somebody else's shoes to shine. Or greasy pots in a dirty kitchen. I've been running this elevator too long. I guess I'll quit now. So the fellow quits that elevator job, goes and gets a job running an elevator somewhere else, but at least he has a change of scenery. I decided after several months of working at dull jobs that wouldn't lead any place at all, low pay, to get a job on a boat. So I went down to the waterfront, and after several weeks of walking up and down the dock fronts, I finally got a job on a boat. Well, here's a poem that I wrote at that time called Waterfront Streets, about those ugly dockfront streets that nevertheless have about them a feeling of romance and far-off places. This little lyric tries to put into verse the way that I felt at that time. The spring is not so beautiful there, but dream ships sail away to where the spring is wondrous rare and life is gay. The spring is not so beautiful there, but lads put out to sea who carry beauties in their hearts and dreams like me. Well, one of my dreams had always been to see Africa, the motherland of the Negro people. I never hoped to really get that far away, but I had the good luck to find myself working on a boat going to Africa, my very first job at sea. We went all up and down the West Coast, up the Congo River and up the Niger River and almost down to Cape Town in the south. And then we came back up the West Coast and then to the Canary Islands before we came home. And so I had a view of all of one side of Africa. And that trip greatly influenced my thinking, my work, my writing. For one thing, I acquired a new pride in my own racial background. When I was a child, the geographies always pictured Africans as a frightful, savage, bushy-headed people, you know. I'm glad to say that that picturing of the primitive peoples has changed in textbooks in our time, but A long time ago, they always pictured them as completely savage and frightful people. Well, I found the Africans weren't that way at all. Even way up the Congo River, the tribes up there that wore almost nothing except a loincloth were nevertheless as polite, as kind to strangers as people are here. They seemed to me just about as civilized as people are here. Those who could speak English or had access to interpreters were interested in problems and things going on in our country, and a great many of them even had heard about Harlem. And so I liked the Africans. And I wrote a number of poems during and shortly after that trip. I will read you just one of them. I'll read you the shortest one of them, a poem called My People. The night is beautiful, so the faces of my people. The stars are beautiful, so the eyes of my people. Beautiful also is the sun. Beautiful also are the souls of my people. I learned in Africa that our country is certainly not the only country with a color problem, that color problems existed right in Africa itself. I saw, to my surprise, in the very first port to which our ship went, signs up outside of restaurants and other public places that said, Europeans only. And I learned that those signs really meant white people only. All up and down the African coast, I saw various forms of discrimination between the Europeans who ran the African colonies and the African people themselves. And in one colony, I even saw a missionary church with a brass rail across the middle of the church, and the white people who were bringing Christianity to the natives all sat in front of the brass rail, and the Africans themselves were segregated behind the brass rail. Well, I sort of wanted to see the Europe that ran Africa. And so when I came back, I got a job on a boat going across to Europe, a boat going to Rotterdam. This trip to Europe was quite different, however, in point of comfort than the African trip. The African trip had been made in calm weather. We came back in the early fall before the ocean got too rough. But my first trip across the Atlantic in the winter was an extremely rough one. The little freight boat that I was working on was not too much longer than this room, a very small boat. So it rocked and tossed and rolled all the way across the Atlantic. We should have made the trip in 10 days. It took us 17. The second trip was even worse. When we made the second trip across, one of the biggest storms in the history of shipping, it seems, came up, and we were 22 days getting from New York to Rotterdam. And every one of those 22 days, the boat rocked and rolled so that your whole body got sore just trying to hold your balance, you know? And some nights, if you wanted to be sure of being in your bunk in the morning, you had to tie yourself in because of the lurching of the boat. Some very unfortunate things happened, too, on that trip. The chief engineer got pneumonia. If you get seriously ill on a freight boat, there are no doctors, and so if you get very sick, there's nothing to do except go ahead on and die, and this man died. I saw my first funeral at sea. They wrap your body up in a piece of canvas and put it on a board, and then they push the board up to the edge of the boat, cover you with an American flag, and the captain says a few words over your body, and then they lift up the board and let you slide off into the ocean. But they hold on to the flag and put it away for the next funeral. One of the mess boys was severely scalded, a pot of soup overturned in the galley. Our wireless man lost his mind in mid-ocean. We had no use of the wireless. And so when this boat finally did get to Rotterdam, I thought to myself, there might be a jinx on this old ship. It might sink going back, and I better get off. So I did. I had $25 coming. I wanted to see Paris anyway. So I drew my $25 and bought a ticket to Paris. After I'd paid for my visa and a few things that had to be done to cross the border, I got to Paris very early one morning, the middle of February, with only $7 left. Well, I didn't know a soul in all of Europe, didn't know anybody in Paris at all, but I thought I knew French quite well because I'd had 3 years in high school and a year at Columbia, and so I was sure that I could find a job quite easily in Paris with my command of the language. But it turned out that the very first time I opened my mouth and tried to order my breakfast at the buffet in the Gare du Nord in the station there, they didn't understand a word I said. I said, donnez-moi des oeufs, s'il vous plaît, du jambon. And nobody moved to give me anything. I was trying to order ham and eggs. I didn't realize that the French people don't eat ham and eggs anyway for breakfast, but they might have at least understood the words, I thought. So I repeated, des oeufs, s'il vous plaît, du jambon, s'il vous plaît. Didn't get a thing. Well, I saw the coffee urn bubbling at one end of the counter and some very nice brioche hot rolls right in front of me. So I pointed at the coffee urn, I pointed at the rolls, and right away I got coffee and rolls. So I learned my very first day in Paris that you don't really need to know a foreign language in a foreign country if you just use sign language. You get almost anything you want except a job. I couldn't get a job with sign language. So for over 3 weeks, I lived on coffee and rolls, or rather, I should say, coffee and a roll per meal, because that's all I could afford. And I finally found a job as a doorman in a nightclub. There was no salary, but you did get your dinner when you went to work and your supper at midnight. So that was a pretty good salary for me at that time, as hungry as I was, and tips, of course. However, after I'd been working there a few nights, I discovered that it was a kind of underworld, gangster-type nightclub, frequented largely by people from Central Europe and Turkey and Asia Minor, and they fought a great deal inside, and they fought in all the languages of Central Europe, and I never quite knew what they were fighting about, but I was supposed to be the bouncer and throw people out. So I didn't stay there very long. I found another job as a second cook in a much more respectable nightclub, in fact, one that became quite well-known, the Grand Duke. When they asked me could I cook, I said, oh, yes, I really couldn't cook a thing. But fortunately for me, the title second cook meant dishwasher anyway, so it turned out to be a job I could hold. I worked in the Grand Duke in the Rue Pigalle for some 7 months, and every night washing pots and pans back in the kitchen, I used to hear the jazz band playing, a very good Negro jazz band from New York, and the beat of this syncopated music sort of got into my blood, and I began to try to reproduce it in poetry. And it was my so-called jazz poems, at least that's what the critics call them then, that began my professional literary career, because these were the first poems that I sold. The Crisis and other magazines that were kind enough to publish my poetry formally didn't pay anything. But now I begin to sell poems. I got from one magazine as much as 50 cents a line, which is just about a top price, you know, for poetry. And since most of my poems are short, the checks wouldn't be very big, so I very early in my poetic career learned to cut my lines in half, you know, and make them short. And sometimes... sometimes you only have one word for a line, you know? Well, I would like to read you just one of the poems from that period, a poem in which I tried to capture the rhythms of a dance that was sweeping, had already swept America, had begun to sweep the world, a dance called the Charleston. The young people, I imagine, most of you are perhaps not old enough to have seen the Charleston, but I'm sure if you ask any of your professors to show you, they can show you how to do it. I was reading my poems the other day at the University of Kansas and mentioned the period and the Charleston and so on. And afterwards, I was told that the Chancellor Murphy of the University of Kansas, was a champion Charleston dancer in his youth and has two or three Charleston cups. So the Charleston was quite an energetic and exciting dance. And if you've never seen it, ask Mr. Parkinson or somebody to show you how it goes. At any rate, I tried to capture something of the rhythms of that dance in this little poem called Negro Dancers. And it was Josephine Baker who really brought the Charleston to Paris. and became a great international star, beginning with her dancing of the Charleston. Me and my baby's got two more ways to do the Charleston. Da, da, da-da-da, two more ways to do the Charleston. Soft light on the tables, music gay, brown-skinned steppers in a cabaret. White folks laugh, white folks pray. Me and my baby's got two more ways to do the Charleston. Well, other poems of that period were called Jazzonia and To a Young Dancer and Cat and the Saxophone. And these poems began to appear in a number of magazines in New York, and editors began to know my name. And when I got back to this country, I had begun myself to be interested in the folk music from which jazz came, quite consciously now, because I began to sort of go back to the folk sources. And all my life I'd heard blues and spirituals in the little churches out in the Midwest and in Kansas City. And so I began to try to write poems in the manner of the blues and the spirituals. And I think I will read you now one in each style. In the manner of the spirituals, I'll read you a poem called Judgment Day. It's, I guess, like what you might call a shout or a jubilee in style. And then I'll read you a blues. The spirituals, you know, are group songs. They are a folk form that doesn't exist anymore. I mean, it's not an active folk form anymore. Spirituals are, as far as I know, are no longer coming out of the people, no longer being created. The type of song now that is similar to the spiritual is the gospel song, and in my opinion, it is a folk expression, although gospel songs are written by individuals and sung by singers like Mahalia Jackson and the Ward Singers, but the song itself is so close to the people that I think it can be termed a form of folk singing. But gospel songs are not spirituals. Judgment Day. They put my body in the ground. My soul went flying over the town, Lord Jesus. Went flying to the stars and moon, a shouting God, I's coming soon, O Jesus. Lord in heaven, crown on his head, says, don't be afraid, because you ain't dead, kind Jesus. And now I'm setting clean and bright in the sweet of my Lord's sight. Clean and bright, clean and bright. And I'd like to read you one other, which certainly is influenced by the Negro religious expression. This little poem grew out of an incident in my childhood. A very old lady in our church in Lawrence, Kansas, used to come every Sunday morning all dressed up in quite quaint clothes. She probably hadn't bought any new clothes for 25 or 30 years, and so she wore shirt waist with staves up in the collar, way up under her chin, and wide skirts with ruffles around the bottom. And sometimes some of the younger people in the church would be inclined to giggle and laugh a little bit at this quaint old lady in her funny clothes. One Sunday morning, she heard somebody apparently make a remark or something about her. She started down the church aisle, and so she turned around, looked at the group of young people sitting there, and she said, that's all right, she said. Y'all can be stuck up if you wanna, laugh at me if you wanna, but my Lord ain't stuck up. Then she went on down to her seat in the Amen corner. Well, now that line, my Lord ain't stuck up, remained in my subconscious mind for a great many years, I guess, and suddenly it came out in a poem. The poem is called My Lord. My Lord ain't no stuck-up man. My Lord, he ain't proud. When he goes a-walking, he gives me his hand. You, my friend, he loud. My Lord knowed what it was to work. He knowed how to pray. My Lord's life was trouble, too. Trouble every day. My Lord ain't no stuck-up man. He's a friend of mine. When he went to heaven, his soul on fire, he told me I was gwine. He said, sure, you'll come with me and be my friend through eternity. And now for a poem in the manner of the blues. The blues, as you know, are quite worldly songs. They're just the opposite of the spirituals. They're songs very much about the problems right down here on earth, the men's blues, and by the way, blues are individual songs, not group songs like the spirituals, and the men's blues are usually economic blues, really. They're usually about work, or maybe being out of work and broke and hungry, or long ways from home and no money to get a ticket with to go back. And the women's blues are almost always about love. Very often, the woman's blues is about some man who's gone off and left her before she's ready for him to go. I will read you a man's blues. In fact, I think I'll read you one for man and one for woman. I'll read you two blues. This one is called Out of Work, and you can tell how long ago it was written because it mentions the WPA, so you know it's the Depression Time blues. I walked the streets till the shoes wore off my feet. I done walked the streets till the shoes wore off my feet. I've been looking for a job so that I could eat. I couldn't find no job, so I went to the WPA. Couldn't find no job, so I went to the WPA. WPA man told me, you got to live here a year and a day. A year and a day, Lord, in this great big lonesome town. A year and a day in this great big lonesome town. I might starve for a year, but that extra day would get me down. Well, in writing my own poems in the manner of the blues, I try to stick as closely as I can to the authentic folk form and spirit. And one of the qualities of the blues is, of course, that combination of sadness and humor that has gone from the blues over into jazz music. And I think maybe that's why people love our American jazz all around the world, because it has that very combination in it, sadness and humor. Most other popular music is either all happy or all sad, you know? But our music combines both. Well, this is a blues for a woman to sing. It's called Widow Woman. Oh, that last long ride is a ride everybody must take. Yes, that last long ride's a ride everybody must take. And that final stop is a stop everybody must make. When they put you in the ground and they throw dirt in your face. I say, put you in the ground and throw dirt in your face. That's one time, pretty papa, you'll sure stay in your place. You was a mighty lover, and you ruled me many years. A mighty lover, baby, you ruled me many years. If I live to be 1,000, I'll never dry these tears. I don't want nobody else, and don't nobody else want me. I say I don't want nobody else, and don't nobody else want me. Yet you never can tell when a woman like me is free. Well, when I got back to the United States from my travels abroad, I worked my way back on another freighter. I sent a poem of mine to Opportunity Magazine's first literary contest. Opportunity was the journal of the National Urban League, and most of my early publication was in Negro publications. Well, I won this contest. I got the first prize for poetry with this poem called The Weary Blues. And about the same time, I was working at the Warden Park Hotel in Washington as a busboy, hoping to go to Howard. They wanted me to come to New York to get my prize at a awards banquet. It was $50, so I spent the prize going after it, but the publicity resulting from it was of such a nature that Alfred A. Knopf wrote me and asked me if I had enough poems to make a book, and I did have. My first book of poems was accepted by Knopf and published under the title of The Weary Blues, my prize-winning poem. Well, just before this happened, into the dining room of the Wardman Park Hotel in Washington one day came Vachel Lindsay, our very great American poet whom I had liked and admired so much and had never seen. He was going to read his poems in the little theater of the hotel that night. I knew that, but I also knew that I could not go to hear him read his poems, because at that time in Washington, colored people couldn't go to any of the theaters in all of Washington, our national capital, except those right in the Negro neighborhoods. Well, I went into the pantry when I saw Vachel Lindsay come into the dining room at lunchtime and wrote down three of my poems, including the Weary Blues, and came back into the dining room and put them down beside his plate. He was dining alone, and I said, I've liked your poems very much, and I try to write poetry too, and here's some of mine. Went away. Well, I didn't see Vachel Lindsay anymore, never. But the next morning, when I went to work, about 6:30 in the morning, the head waiter came out in the kitchen. He said, you're Langston Hughes? And I said, yes. And he said, well, there are newspaper reporters and photographers waiting for you in the dining room. And gee, I said, well, what have I done? And he said, well, I don't know, but they're waiting for you in there. And so get your uniform on and go on in there and see what they want. So I quickly put on my white uniform and went into the dining room, and some early risers were already having breakfast, and there was already dirty dishes sitting around, which I was due to remove. And here were these reporters and the cameraman. And they said, you've been discovered. And so they then told me what it was all about. Vachel Lindsay had read my three poems at his reading the night before in the theater of the hotel, and had spoken very beautifully about my work, and it said that right there in this hotel he had discovered a poet. And so the newspaper people interviewed me. They took my picture holding up a tray of dirty dishes in the middle of the dining room, and that interview and that picture went all over the country, syndicated by United Press. So that was my first publicity break. And so my literary career was really beginning. Well, I didn't get to go to Howard. I went to Lincoln University. I got a scholarship through my poetry to go finish my 3 years of college. And I was very happy later to be able to write my father and tell him that you didn't send me through college, but poetry did. I graduated from Lincoln in 1929, and ever since then I've been making my living as a professional writer. So that is the background for my work. And now in closing, I would like to read you perhaps a half a dozen or so of my more serious poems. I guess I'm best known as a writer of poems about the problems of the Negro people in relation to democracy. At least it's those poems of mine that seem to be most often anthologized and most often reprinted. And for a great many years, of course, I have been writing such poems. They certainly grew right out of the problems that I myself as an individual have faced and have known, but in expressing my own personal problems, in this case certainly I express the problems of millions of other colored people. Some critics have called me a social poet, and I think that I am. Some have termed me a documentary poet, and some have called me a propaganda poet. Well, when they use that word, they didn't mean it very nicely, usually, but anyway, I would admit to being all three. It doesn't really seem to make much difference to me what one is called. Anyway, but certainly much of my poetry is social, and much of it is a kind of propaganda, if you want to say so, or special pleading for the cause of the Negro achieving greater democracy, achieving all the rights that other Americans have. The little poem of mine that is most often used by race relation groups is one called Merry-Go-Round. And I think maybe this poem has been used so much because it presents the race problem very simply through the eyes of a child. It was written during the war, and every time there's a war, there's a great migration of Negro workers from the South to the North. They come up to work in the war plants and factories. And I imagined in my own mind a little girl of maybe 7 or 8 years old coming up with her family to maybe a town like Oakland, or could be Portland, Oregon, or could be Omaha, or could be Newark, New Jersey. And in a northern or western city, this little colored girl goes to a carnival, and she sees a merry-go-round going around, and she wants to ride. But remembering the South, the legal Jim Crow, and segregation on the buses and trains and schools and all, she doesn't know whether she can ride on the merry-go-round or not in a northern town. And if she can ride, she doesn't know where. So this is what she says. "Where is the Jim Crow section on this merry-go-round, mister? 'Cause I want to ride. Down south where I come from, white and colored can't sit side by side. Down south on the train, there's a Jim Crow car. On the bus, we're put in the back. But there ain't no back to a merry-go-round. Where's a horse for a kid that's black?" Well, of course, I feel that our country's big enough and rich enough to have a horse for every kid. And I'm sure someday we will. Another poem of mine is a poem about the problems of voting in the Deep South. You know, there are some sections of our country where the very basic right of democracy, the ballot, if a Negro tries to take advantage of it, is taking his life in his hands. This poem is called Ku Klux, about the Ku Klux Klan. It's what happened to a young man who wanted to vote. He tells it in his own words, and this is what he says. "They took me out to some lonesome place. They said, 'Do you believe in the great white race?' I said, 'Mister, to tell you the truth, I'd believe in anything if you just turn me loose.' The white man said, 'Boy, can it be you are standing there assassin' me?' They hit me in the head and knocked me down, and then they kicked me on the ground. A Klansman said, 'Listen, look me in the face and tell me you believe in the great white race.'" Well, of course, we fought a war to defeat that sort of race superiority theories in Europe. We haven't entirely defeated them by any means in our own country, as all of you know. However, the extremes of Little Rock and the bombings of schools and Birmingham and Clinton, Tennessee, do not represent all of America nor the feelings of all Americans, as we all very well know here. Those of you who live in a community like Berkeley, a liberal university town where you're not faced with the race problem every day, or living in New York, as I do, where you almost never run bang into it anymore, you are inclined to forget what it's like if you live in a town like Birmingham or Houston, Texas, or almost any other town you can name in the South. Of course, one of the peculiarities of the race problem is how it varies so much from one place to another. But on the other hand, that's also one of the aggravations of it, because if you're colored, you never quite know what you can do where. Even in the Deep South, I have traveled a great deal by air in the last 10 or 15 years, and there are two towns within 40 miles of each other, Houston and Dallas. I don't believe they're any further apart. And unless it's changed in one of those towns, you would arrive at the airport, and you could get into the airport limousine or taxi and go on into the city. But the other town, only a few minutes away by air, come out at the airport, the taxis will not carry colored people. The airport limousine will not carry colored people. You have to phone all the way in town for a Negro taxi to get transportation. Well, now, how can you know that if you don't live there? You don't know it. But there you are, find yourself 2 hours later getting in town when you'd expect it to be there sooner. Well, take the problem in the North, for example. Let's go way up north. It was Tacoma, Washington, when I got off the train up there one time, had to take a bus to go somewhere else, not too far away, to read my poems. And there was no restaurant in the station, so I went across the street, and there was a sign up Colored people, colored patronage not desired, I believe the sign said, right in the window of the restaurant. So I went back across into the station. I asked a red cap where Negro travelers could eat. And he said, well, now, we have to walk about 4 blocks down that way, and then you go 2 blocks that way, and you'll come to a Japanese restaurant where we can eat. Well, now, here I am, an American citizen in an American town, have to find a Japanese restaurant to get something to eat. And that's not in the South. And sometimes I think the problem of democracy really boils down to a hamburger and a cup of coffee. Because there's so many places in our country right now where if you're colored, you can't even get a hamburger and a cup of coffee. Well, just one or two other poems. In spite of the widespread problem, and in spite of the fact that although it's being partially solved here and there, it's certainly not solved on a national scale yet, there are many hopeful signs and some really big achievements in race relations in the last 10 or 12 years, and we all know what they are, so I won't go over them. And so I feel really quite hopeful about our democracy, and I feel that we certainly will in time, but I wish it weren't such a long time, work out all the problems. And in a poem like this one, I try to express my faith and optimism in the future. I too sing America. I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes, but I laugh and eat well and grow strong. Tomorrow, I'll be at the table when company comes. Nobody'll dare say to me, eat in the kitchen then. Besides, they'll see how beautiful I am and be ashamed. I, too, am America. In New York during the war and afterward, when we had coming into our country through the Port of New York so many refugees from oppression in Europe, refugees from Hitlerism and fascism, sometimes Negro citizens would be a little envious of these refugees because they could come into New York and within a few months have a very good job that if you were colored and been living in New York all your life, you couldn't get. They could go move down to Birmingham and become naturalized and in a few years vote and ride anywhere they wanted to on the buses or cars. Negroes born in Birmingham couldn't do it. Well, I felt there was a kind of kinship between these refugees and ourselves in terms of the oppression each group of us had known and also in terms of our desire for the kind of freedom that America really represents. And so I wrote this poem, a poem called A Refugee in America. And it's from my book of poems, Fields of Wonder, which is, I think, my favorite book of poems of my 8 books of poems. It's my only book of lyric poems, and most of the poems are very tiny little poems, if you can see them, in the center of a page and on very beautiful paper. It's a Knopf book, and Knopf makes really quite beautiful books. And this book, with this beautiful paper, came out during the war. So one of the critics who, I guess, thought all of my poetry should be folk poetry and blues didn't like this book very well. He liked much better other books of mine that he named in my blues and humorous poems. And this particular critic said, oh, what a shame to waste all that good paper on such little old poems. Well, these little poems, however, happen to be among my own favorites. And I would like to read you more than just one from this book. I'd like to read you 2 or 3 of these lyrics. I will read you the Refugee in America one. There are words like freedom, sweet and wonderful to say. On my heartstrings, freedom sings all day, every day. There are words like liberty that almost make me cry. If you had known what I knew, you would know why. And another of the lyrics in this book is one called Heaven. Heaven is a place where happiness is everywhere. Animals and birds sing, as does everything. To each stone, how do you do? Stone says, I'm all right, how are you? And I'll read you one called Borderline. I used to wonder about living and dying. I think the difference lies between tears and crying. I used to wonder about here and there. I think the distance is nowhere. Well, I think the distance between Americans of whatever racial background they might be is really nowhere. And when we really get to know each other well, as communities where we do know each other well and where we do go to school together and get along together prove, there are really not very many problems, if any. This final poem tries to say that we're all going to be Americans together tomorrow. In my own family, there was a long tradition of fighting and struggling to achieve the ideals of liberty and freedom and democracy. My grandfather was a part of the Underground Railroad. He was a Negro who worked with the Quakers in Ohio, in Oberlin, who helped to rescue slaves to get them across the lake into Canada. And he served time in prison for helping people get to freedom. My granduncle, his brother, helped to break down some of the barriers in Washington as long ago as 60 or 70 years, because when Negroes even then tried to move into decent housing and build homes in communities where there were trees and grass, it seemed that many white people didn't want them to do so. And it seemed that my granduncle bought a house in a fairly decent neighborhood, not a fine one at all, but there were trees and lawns and paved streets. And the white people built barriers at either end of the street to keep him from driving into the roadway with his horse and carriage. It seemed that he had a beautiful white horse and a carriage. And so my granduncle, simply stopped at a hardware store and bought himself an axe and drove up in his white horse and carriage and stepped out in his tail coat. He was a politician. He wore a tail coat and a high hat. Stepped out with his axe and broke the barriers down. And they've never been there anymore. Well, also, however, in our family, all the time I heard about the white people who were also for liberty and freedom and democracy and who helped Negroes to achieve it, and how the Quakers, the white Quakers, often sacrificed their lives. They were sometimes set upon by the slave hunters and the paddlerollers, as they called them in those days, and beaten and killed because they were suspected of helping slaves become free. And we all know how many thousands of whites died in the Civil War to help bring about freedom. And then we know how in our own time, white Americans, some of them at the risk of their own personal careers, have helped to fight for the things that really mean democracy to all of us. And so my feeling is that in our country, there are so many people who really want to make America what it's supposed to be that there's no way really of our not achieving that objective for all of us soon, I hope soon, but I've lived an awful long time myself, and it hasn't happened yet. At any rate, this poem is called Tomorrow. It goes like this. We have tomorrow, bright before us like a flame. Yesterday, a night-gone thing, a sundown name. And dawn today, broad arch above the road we came. We march, Americans together, we march.